Good afternoon. We open your Bibles to Revelation chapter 7. We're going to begin there in just a moment. Revelation chapter 7. Feels like it's been a while since we have been together to talk about the book of Revelation. But just to get into what we're talking about and reminding ourselves of what we're talking about, Revelation chapters, chapter 1, we have an introduction. We introduce ourselves to Jesus, and Jesus is very different from what he looked like while he was on earth. He's no longer the carpenter, he is the victorious leader. Chapters 2 and 3, Jesus sends messages to the seven churches of Asia. He sends these different messages, messages that give hope, but also give correction and give an understanding of what the Christians need to do. They are messages also about the tribulation that is going on among the Christians and how the Lord is going to come quickly, how things are going to change very quickly, and they need to repent. We're taken away from that vision, and we're taken, John is taken up to heaven in chapter 4 and 5, where we have this heavenly vision of God upon his throne. And we see the Father sitting on his throne and myriad of angels all around him, with elders and living creatures. Everyone is praising the Father. But in chapter 5, we meet Jesus again. This time, he is the lion of the tribe of Judah. But then we look at him, and he is the lamb, a lamb that has been slain. Alive. And so obviously we're talking about Jesus. And Jesus comes, the Lamb comes, and takes this scroll that is in the right hand of the Father. And he takes the scroll, and as soon as he takes the scroll, it's immediately everyone erupts in praise of the Lamb, but then also he who sits on the throne of the Father as well. And so there's praise for everyone, but still we're remembering the Lamb has something in his hand now, and this is the revelation of the Father. This is what the Father is going to do about the great tribulation that's going to happen among the Christians very, very soon. This is revelation about what he is doing. And so in chapter 6, we begin to read this revelation. We read the scrolls, and it is a scroll that is sealed with seven seals. And with each seal that you open, there's a little bit more revelation that you get to read. And so one seal is opened by the Lamb, by Jesus. And as that opens, then a white horse comes out. This is a messenger sent to execute the judgments of God upon the people. Open up another seal. Here's another judgment of God. And God is using this messenger to execute his judgments upon his enemies. Finally, there are four seals that are like that. One, two, three, four. Four horses that are sent out executing God's judgment. The fifth is a little different. The fifth seal is open, and saints are pictured underneath an altar. And they're asking a question. How long, O Lord? How long are you going to wait to avenge our blood? We have been destroyed by your enemies. How long will you allow them to continue like this? So the sixth seal then is open, and God answers. First he answers, and he says to those saints who are under the altar, he says, just wait. Wait until the rest of your comrades, until the rest of the Christians around there are also going to be killed, and they're going to join you in heaven. But also to answer this question, how long, O Lord, in verse chapter 6 and verse 12 through 17, the Lamb opens up the seal and there is just the whole earth. It feels like it's about to tear apart. You have earthquakes and the sun is blackened and the moon turns into blood. And just it feels like the world is coming apart. And even the kings realize that they are in trouble because the Father is showing his wrath and showing his power. That was the sixth seal. There are seven seals total. And so when we get to chapter 7, we are imagining or we're thinking that, oh, here comes the seventh seal. The sixth seal was pretty bad. That was huge. God is like flexing his muscles. What's going to happen then when he opens up the seventh seal?
However, when we get to chapter 7,
instead of the opening of the seventh seal, there is a pause. There is a pause. And so we read about this in chapter 7 and verse 1. It says, "After this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. I also saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels, whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, Do not harm the earth, or the sea, or the trees, until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. And the number of those who received 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." I want to pause right there and just talk about what's going on here. We have this strange picture of now, instead of a seal being opened up, now we see these angels who are, it looks like they're holding back the winds. And holding back these winds, and then another angel says, don't let go of those winds, don't let go of that destruction, until these people, these 144,000, are sealed with the seal of God on their foreheads. This is going to become a big theme throughout the book of Revelation, the idea of the sealing of God's people. Later on, it corresponds with the idea of the mark of a beast. You only have two options. Either you are marked by the mark of the beast, or you are sealed by the seal of God. And those two ideas, they're opposite ideas. But what does that mean of all of this? I'd like to take a moment right here in Revelation chapter 7. So if you can put a marker there, I think it would be helpful if we go back to the Old Testament. Back to the Old Testament in Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but so often I've already said that when you want to know more about the book of Revelation, the most likely place to find more information is to go back to the Old Testament. So many of the ideas and figures and questions that we might have in the book of Revelation, we find more ideas and instructions in the Old Testament. And so in Ezekiel chapter 8, we read some things here. Just to give us an idea of what's going on in Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a prophet that prophesied during the captivity of Israel. So Israel has been wicked. The Israelites have fallen to idolatry, and to the north, they have been very wicked in Samaria, and they have fallen to idolatry. And so God, in 722 BC, took them away to the nation of Assyria, and they were physically taken out of their houses and moved away into a foreign land. In the south, Judah was a little better. We have Hezekiah, Josiah, several good kings that wanted to help Judah and Jerusalem to continue on and doing the things of God. But how do you stem the flood? There are many prophets that are sent, but the people do not listen to the prophets. And so finally, Jerusalem follows the sins of their cousins, the example of their cousins, and they also fall to idolatry and the sins of the nations around them. And so they are moved away to captivity. Jerusalem itself is destroyed in 586 BC. Ezekiel is a prophet that prophesies, that writes this book from captivity. He himself has moved out of Jerusalem, and now he's in Babylon. And he's writing and speaking to the elders and trying, really, a lot of the book of Ezekiel is all about convincing the people in Judah, or the people who have been moved out of Jerusalem and moved over to Babylon, trying to convince them, no, we really did sin. No, this is why God did this. No, this is why God did this. And in fact, you don't need to hold out for Jerusalem. And at the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, Jerusalem has not been destroyed yet. And so some have high hopes that maybe God will make an exception, maybe God will change his mind, and maybe God will finally bring back and bring some type of victory for Jerusalem. But so much of the book of Ezekiel is going to be about, no, don't hold out on Jerusalem. Jerusalem will be destroyed, and this is why. It will be destroyed, and this is why. So much of the book of Ezekiel is about this is the sin of Israel. I guess if we could say the same thing for a lot of the prophets of the Old Testament. But that, all that brings us to Ezekiel chapter 7, and just to show a few of the connections here. In Ezekiel chapter 7, in verse 1, it says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, You, son of man, thus says the Lord Yahweh to the land of Israel, at an end, the end is coming on the four corners of the land. The end is coming upon you, and I will send my anger upon you, and I will judge you according to your ways and bring all your abominations on you. For my eye will have no pity." That's a good verse or a good phrase to keep in mind as we go through the book of, or these next few chapters. Because he says, "My eye will have no pity on you, and nor will I spare you. But I will bring your ways upon you, and your abominations will be among you. Then you will know that I am Yahweh." And so in these sections, he's saying, number one, the end is coming on the four corners of the land. So this is interesting. It's similar to what we have in the book of Revelation. But what is the big moment or the big phrase here? "I'm going to come with destruction upon Jerusalem, and there will be no pity." God, why are you doing this? What is the reason why God is showing his wrath? Well, in Ezekiel chapter 8, we have a new vision. In Ezekiel chapter 8, in verse 1, it describes how Ezekiel is taken in the spirit. He's plucked up, in fact, by the hair of his head. And he's taken all the way from Babylon, all the way over to Jerusalem. And he has the opportunity to witness some of the abominations of the city. Let's read together. In Ezekiel chapter 8, in verse 1, "It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house, with the elders of Judah sitting before me at the hand of the Lord, that the hand of the Lord Yahweh fell upon me there." So he is in Babylon, but now, and he's sitting with the elders of Judah, they're just kind of sitting around, but then all of a sudden he receives this vision. Verse 2, "Then I looked, and behold, a likeness of the appearance of a man. From his loins and downward, there was an appearance of fire, and from his loins and upward, an appearance of brightness, like the appearance of glowing metal. He stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by the lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up from between earth, lifted me up between earth and heaven, and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, was located. And behold, the glory of the Lord of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw in the plain." And so he talks about being taken in a vision and grabbed by the hair and dragged over to Jerusalem. So he's in Babylon, but in the vision, he's taken over to Jerusalem. And the idea is he's going to be able to witness some things of what's going on, really, in there in Jerusalem. And off the bat, we see some things that are kind of worrisome. First of all, in verse 3, he says he comes to the north gate, and what does he see there? Where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, was located. So he sees this idol. Where? In the temple of God. But God says to him in verse 5, "Then he said to me, Son of man, raise your eyes toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gate was the idol of jealousy at the entrance. Then he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abomination of which the house of Israel are committing, so that they would be far from my sanctuary. But yet I will show you still greater abominations." So what does he say? Look, you see this, Ezekiel? Do you see what they're doing? Do you see that they're doing it here in my temple? And then he says, I'm going to show you something even worse than that. You thought that was bad? I'm going to show you even greater abominations. And what happens throughout the rest of the chapter is he goes through and says, look at that, look at that, look at that. You thought that was bad? Let me show you greater abominations. In verse in verse 13, for example. And he said to me, yet you will see greater abominations. In verse 14, he sees women who are worshiping this god called Tammuz. In verse 15, he says, do you see that, son of man? You will see greater abominations. And then finally, in verse 16, he was brought into the inner portion of the Lord's house, and he sees these 25 men with their backs to the temple of Yahweh and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. What are they worshiping? Worshiping the sun. Their backs are toward God, and they're worshiping the sun. What's the idea? They turn their back on God, and now they're worshiping the sun. He said to me in verse 16, verse 17, do you see this, O son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they have committed there? That they have filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly. For behold, they are putting the twig to their nose. I don't know exactly what that means, that they're putting the twig to their nose. It's kind of a strange phrase, but it's something really bad. It's almost like, we have the phrase, he's kind of thumbing his nose at me. They're taunting God. Either way, it's not a good thing. And so therefore, what's the phrase? What is the reaction of God in verse 18? Therefore, I indeed will deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, that I will not listen to them. And so comes chapter 9. In chapter 9, he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And so six men came from the direction of the upper gate with their faces north, and each with a shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case at his loins. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. So you have, God says, come on in, boys. Bring in the six men. And these six men come in, and each one of them have a shattering weapon. I don't know what that shattering weapon looks like, but it has to be something really, really cruel. Here is this angel of God, these angels of God that are going to come in, and they're going to do great destruction. These six of them, you can imagine what kind of fear then Ezekiel has for the people of God there. However, there was one man, one angelic figure, who was a little different. And instead of having a shattering weapon, what did he have? He had a writing utensil, a writing case. What is he doing here? Verse 3. The glory of God of Israel went up from the cherubim on which he had been to the threshold of the temple. And he went and he called to the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case. Yahweh said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in their midst. So he tells the guy with the writing utensil to do what? Go into Jerusalem and write. Put a mark. And we say put a seal on the foreheads of all the people who sigh and groan over the abominations. What does that mean, to sigh and groan? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's a good thing in this case. They are sighing and they're groaning. And they don't want to have anything to do with the abominations of the people. They're very sad that Jerusalem has gone in this direction. So they have a heart for God. God says, I want you to go through and identify each and every one of them. Put a sign on their foreheads. But to the others, he says in my hearing, go throughout the city and have him strike, and do not let your eyes have pity, and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, women. But do not touch any man on whom is the mark. And you shall start from my sanctuary. And they started with the elders who were then before the temple. And so these elders who are there worshiping the sun, start with them. Start at the temple. Cleanse the temple. And that's what's happening. And we're cleansing Jerusalem, wiping everybody out. The idea is that God is going to take the people there in Jerusalem, and he's going to destroy everybody who's there. Except what? He says, don't touch those who I have marked. He says in verse 8 then, as they were striking the people, I alone was left, Ezekiel speaking. I fell on my face and I cried out, saying, alas, Lord Yahweh, are you destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out your wrath on Jerusalem? He said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is very great, and the land is filled with blood. The city is full of perversion. For they say, Yahweh has forsaken the land, and the Lord does not see. But as for me, my eye will have no pity, nor will I spare, but I will bring their conduct upon their heads. Then behold, the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case reported, saying, I have done just as you have commanded me. What is the picture we have? God is coming into Jerusalem and he is destroying the people, his own people. Why? Because of their great sins, because of their abominations. God is coming in with great force. However, he is also taking into account that there are some righteous among this wicked, in this wicked city. And so does he treat everyone just in the same way? Well, sorry, you're just in the city. You're gonna receive everything just like that, just like everybody else does. God has such great power and knowledge that he's able to know the hearts of individuals who do moan and groan, and he is able to seal them, to mark them, to know them, identify them, and protect them from his wrath. That's the idea that we have here. Now, literally, what happened in the city of Jerusalem? I think all of this is happening in a vision. Ezekiel's still in Babylon. It's not like he's literally seeing these, well, he's literally seeing them, but these are spiritual things that are happening. I don't think that literally the next morning people woke up and said, Joseph, what is that on your forehead? What do you have written there? It's not like there's a literal mark upon their forehead. And what happened to the people of Jerusalem? Are we to think that all of the people who died in Jerusalem were wicked and all of the people who are good were miraculously saved? Later on in the book of Ezekiel, we see that all of the people, even the wicked and the just, were died. But how do we mesh that with this right here? Whatever happens in the book of Ezekiel, whatever destruction is poured out upon the book of Jerusalem, here's the point. God knows who are his. And even though they might die physically, spiritually they are protected by God. That is such an important point. And that is the point that we want to see then in the book of Revelation. Let's go back to the book of Revelation. So in Revelation chapter 7, we have the same thing going on. We have these six seals that are already open, and God's wrath is just poured out upon the enemies of God. We have a question. What's the seventh seal going to be like? Well, before God shows his complete wrath in the seventh seal, what does he do? He goes through and he seals, he identifies and protects those who are his. He goes through and identifies. He says in verse 3, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. And so that's what they did in verse 4. They go around, they seal all the individuals, and there are 144,000 from every tribe of the sons of Israel. Very quickly, just to make sure that we're on the same page, the 144,000 is not going to be just like all of the other numbers in the book of Revelation. That's not a literal number. 144,000, we arrive at that number very easily by multiplying 12, that is representative of the people of God, times the 12 tribes. In verse 5, we have the tribe of Judah, the 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Asher, and Naphtali, and Manasseh, and Simeon, and Levi, and Zebulun, and Joseph, and Benjamin. You have 12 tribes that are mentioned here, and from each of these 12 tribes, there are 12,000. Add all that up together, you're smart with math, we get 144,000. These are not literal numbers. We shouldn't think that there were literally 144,000 Christians in Asia Minor during this time, and they were the only ones who were going to be saved. But this is a representation of all of God's people. These are God's people, 12 tribes, 12,000 from each of these 12 tribes. But they are identified, and they are the ones that are going to be saved. I think it's interesting, though, when we look at this 144,000, we also ought to say that we're also not looking at 144,000 literal Jews or literal Israelites. The Christians in this area are generally going to be Gentiles. We're familiar with the fact that in the New Testament, it's not a strange thing that Christians are described as the Israel of God. Romans chapter 2 is an example of this. In Romans chapter 2 and verse 29, Paul is talking about the development of the Old Testament and its fulfillment in Christianity. The gospel that Jesus preached and his apostles preached is about not just that those who are saved are going to be those who are of the nation of Israel, but of those who have faith in Jesus Christ. It says in Romans chapter 2 and verse 29, Paul clearly says, he is a Jew, say in verse 21, but he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, and not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God. This is a clear teaching that we could go to other verses, Philippians chapter 3, Galatians chapter 3, several places throughout the New Testament that give us the idea that according to the Scriptures, if we are Christians, we are the Israel of God. And so, that's why he's describing them, that these Christians as part of this, representing these 12 tribes of Israel. In fact, earlier in the book of Revelation, if you remember in Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3, there were verses like chapter 2 and verse 9, where Christians were identified as the true Jews. He says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. But the slander by those who say they are Jews, but they are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. It's the idea the true spiritual Israel is the one that accepts the Messiah of God. Those who do not accept the Messiah of God are no longer then the true Israel. And so these 144,000 are Christians. They are Christians who are in the world when God is going to pour out his wrath. But what is the promise? They are identified and they are protected by God. Just as you would seal a letter to mark it, this is mine, this one is mine. These 144,000 are identified and protected. In chapters 2 and 3, again going back and thinking about chapters 2 and 3, we were given frequent promises for those who would overcome with the Lamb. And so in this text, these 144,000, these are the overcomers. These are the ones who are faithful to the Lamb, and they will overcome even though they will die physically. And that's what we'll see later on in the book of Revelation. Here, these 144,000 are alive, but later on we'll see them, they will die, but they'll be okay because they are identified and they are protected throughout the book of Revelation. But in verse 9, then, we have a different group that is identified. Let's read verses 9 through 17. Read verses 9 through 17. It said, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation and all the tribes and the peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. And they fell on their faces before the throne and they worshiped God, saying, amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Give glory to God because he knows how to protect his people. And so you have in verse 9 this great multitude, this huge multitude from all sorts of different nations. In verse 13, however, one of the elders answered me saying, these who are clothed in white robes, who are they? Where have they come from? I said to him, good answer, my Lord, you know. He said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, and they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. For this reason, they are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them, and they will hunger no more, nor thirst any more, nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb is in the center of the throne, will be their shepherd, and will guide them to the springs of the water of life. And God will wipe every tear from their eyes. So this great multitude that is identified in verse 9, a people of every tribe, of every nation, of every tongue, they are standing there in white robes, worshiping God. Who are they? Well, they are people who have come through the great tribulation. They had suffered and they had died, but now they are with God. They've come through the tribulation, and now they serve him day and night in his temple. And what a wonderful thing it is to see then, he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. It's this idea then of this protection that he puts around his people. He brings his these people into his tabernacle, and they will be protected. The Lamb will be at its center. They will have fellowship with God and fellowship with the Lamb, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So we have an elder who is here, who is giving explanations to John. But still we're left kind of with the question, well, who are these people? Who are these people who are here? And I'm going to give you two options. One of the options, it's a beautiful picture and a beautiful explanation that these are individuals who are protected. These are individuals who are kept in God's care. One option to look at this is that what we're looking at is Christians who have gone through the tribulation in the sense that these are Christians who have died. Christians who have gone through the tribulation. In other words, they have suffered and they have died, and now, how are they? They've gone to be with Jesus. They've gone to be with God. There is some intentional contrast between the 144,000 and this countless multitude that we ought to appreciate. One, the 144,000 that we have in verse 4. And then later on, in verse 9, you have a great multitude. You also have, earlier, a 144,000 that being pictured as tribe Israel particularly. They're all coming from tribes of Israel. Later on you have, however, multitudes that come from a great number of nations, a great number of tribes, a great number of languages. And so it may be that with this contrast, that these would be then Christians who have been through the tribulation. In fact, the King James translates this in the past tense, who came through the tribulation. In other words, they have died, they've gone to be with the Lord. In this case, these would be individuals like the saints who are under the altar in Revelation chapter 6. Revelation, they're under the altar, they are doing well, they have been given white robes, chapter 6 and verse 9. And if this is correct in their identification, then this is an appropriate message of encouragement for the first readers of the book of Revelation. Your brethren who have already died, Antipas has died, but despite the persecutions, despite the death, your brethren are well, and they have no tears. And there would be a message then for the current readers about their future status as well. Don't be afraid about your tribulation that you're about to go through either, because this is your future as well. There's another way to look at the text, however, in thinking of the identification of these individuals. And I'm not going to be, very strict or very strong about my opinion one way or the other. But it was a thought was brought up to me that maybe what we have here, the 144,000, those who are sealed, who are on earth, could it be that the 144,000 and the great multitude are actually talking about the same individual? Rather than talking about two different groups, maybe they're talking about the same group. What about these contrasts that you have? There are several points at the book of, in the book of Revelation where you do have something that John hears, and then when he looks at it, it looks completely different. Does that make sense? Later on, earlier, for example, he heard the voice of Jesus, and then he turned around, boom, and here is Jesus, like he'd never seen him before. He hears about Jesus as the lion from the tribe of Judah, and then he looks, and he is a lamb. There are several different ways, in other words, to look at one group of people. It is an interesting thought, then, to think about the symbolic nature of the 144,000 in chapter 7, verses 4 through 8, and that some of these contrasting characteristics are not as contrasting as we might think. It's also helpful to note that many times, or so we've seen how the individuals or the figures morph, trying to emphasize certain things throughout the book. However, when we see this, it is interesting that you have the 144,000, and they are sealed, they are protected. What about those who are before the Lamb? The tabernacle is spread over these people. If it is the case that we're talking about the same individuals, what would be the idea, or what would be the message? The message is very similar to what we have in the book of Ephesians, where Paul says to the Christians that even though they are Christians living here on earth, they have already been seated in the heavenly places. It's not just that we are here and only here, but that we, according to Paul in the book of Ephesians, we have a place in heaven already. And the way that God looks at us is different from the way that the people of earth look at us. In fact, throughout the book of Revelation, often the way that the people of God and the people of the world are identified is that the people of the world are identified as those who dwell on the earth. The Christians are identified as those who dwell in heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven. We belong in heaven. So, I don't know exactly if we make a contrast between these two groups, say these two groups are one. In the end, it doesn't matter. Because in the end, it's the same message, isn't it? What is God doing? He is identifying, and he is protecting his own. It doesn't matter who you are, what tribe you come from, or where. If you belong to the Lamb, if you belong to him, then you belong to the victorious Lamb. And you can know that you will have victory with the Lamb. In a very practical way, the book of Revelation helps us to visualize some spiritual ideas. Here, the Christians are, it talks about the Christians being sealed with the seal of God. They are identified by God himself, because they have a relationship with the Lamb. God knows who are his. I think when taking away some ideas from this lesson today, something that gives me great joy and great honor, great encouragement, is to think about God's relationship to us even today. We belong to Jesus Christ. God also knows who we are and has sealed us. He knows who we are. And if we call ourselves Christians, and if we are followers of the Lamb, that's all we need now, and that's all we need for eternity. What we call life now is only life on one side of the tomb. But we need to think about God's protection and where God will take us in the end. In reality, we are ready, we are already, I'm going to read a passage from John chapter 4 in verse 13 and 14, where Jesus says to those who he's speaking to his disciples, and he talks to them about the drink, the water that he has to provide for his people. Jesus answered and said to her, speaking to the Samaritan woman, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I give him will never be thirsty. But the water that I will give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up to eternal life." The relationship that we have with Jesus and what we receive from him will stay with us for all of eternity. Thank you so much for your kindness.